Welcome back to the Missing Maura Murray podcast. Lance, what is up tonight?
What is up indeed, right? I mean, we're coming back from CrimeCon 2017 in Indianapolis and feeling really, really, really good about this experience and about the progress that the Maura Murray case is heading.
What an incredible time meeting everyone who attended, who came up and talked to us, saw our live show and our panel. It was just really surreal and really fun.
When we do this over Skype, and we're in our own little bubble here, and it was, well, first of all, it started off so fast. We got there, we set up, and people were already there, and they were already starting to talk to us, so it didn't really sink in until about maybe the next morning or towards the middle of the next morning what this was all about. And it was really cool to see the people that listened to the show, to see peers in an industry that is so new and so important, this podcast industry, to see your peers out there supporting you and you're supporting them and you're talking with them and to also to talk with the people who are real experts on true crime.
And so for this episode tonight, we have a live recording that we did at CrimeCon on Saturday afternoon. You, me, and James Renner were there, and about maybe 75 of our closest friends in the room with us. And so you can actually hear them. At some points they're laughing. And towards the end, they ask some questions. And one of our buddies, one of our new friends, John Ronson, was there and actually asked a few questions. So that was really fun to interact with him on that level. I can't actually believe he was even there asking us questions.
It was crazy. And I know, speaking for myself and I don't know, maybe speaking a bit for you, but I think all of the hecticness of getting to Indianapolis and getting to CrimeCon and setting up the table, and by the time we got to that live podcast, I think my brain and my body and everything was figuring out like how incredible this was, and I was scared as shit going on there and getting up to talk to these people, and I think that might have been the first thing I said, and I really don't really remember what I said during that, but it was something else. It was something else to see someone like John Ronson raise his hand.
Yeah, it was really cool to hear the questions and to look out at the audience and see the faces of our listeners. And we had just decided really what direction to go with this the night before, because we were doing a panel on Sunday morning and we had this live show and we had James Renner on both of them. So we just didn't want to be repetitive. So some of the things that you'll hear in this live episode: first, we talk briefly about the brand new Oxygen television show, which is about the Maura Murray case specifically, a 6-part TV show about Maura Murray. More info on that coming soon. You'll hear a little bit more in this, but much more information about that coming soon. But the majority of the episode, we focus on our experience with trolls, actually, internet trolls. During this few years that we've been doing this.
Right, and it really went in. I was a little bit skeptical about doing a topic specifically about trolls because I felt like people wanted to hear about the cases that we're working on. And talking about trolls, I didn't want them to feel like we were shortchanging them. But as everything happens with what we talk about and who we talk to and who listens and having them ask questions, it really, I realized that it was the right direction to go in because it was a whole angle that we almost got into in the beginning, but then we pulled back because we realized how much of a cycle of madness that could really be. And we could really fall into that cycle and not focus on the cases that we talk about if we just start focusing on the trolls. So it was kind of refreshing to talk about things that we weren't able to talk about that did actually bother us and did affect how we recorded. And it was a lot easier to do when you have the faces of your listeners looking at you and smiling and nodding and chuckling along with you. And then you realize it, you know, really wasn't that big of a deal saying it out loud right now.
Yeah, it was almost therapeutic, I think, for us. And it was really just more about kind of telling stories. And I think we all have some pretty interesting ones about our experiences doing these and how awkward and dark they can actually get, you know, when you internalize what is happening. So some stories you may have heard before, but probably most of them you haven't.
And I wanted to say before we go to the episode that the organizers of CrimeCon 2017 were awesome. The hotel, the JW Marriott in downtown Indianapolis, was awesome. And the people who attended, the listeners and our peers, our podcasting peers who attended, were awesome. And there was a notable missing, a notable absence there. And he knows who he is, and I'm not going to say specifically that it's a nighttime podcast, but he really should have been there. Maybe 2018 in Nashville will be his year to come out, but
hopefully he can make it. But yeah, it was a lot of fun talking to our listeners and also having drinks with them. I mean, we had drinks with some of the people who we recognized from the crowd, you know, the night before. So that was a lot of fun too. Okay, so without further ado, let's play this audio, Lance. Thank you very much for listening, and please follow us on Twitter at Maura Murray Doc, D-O-C. And there will be more information coming soon about this TV show, so please follow us closely on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Thank you. What are you looking forward to cooking with Blue Apron?
Tim, I gotta tell you, I looked over the menu and warm smoked trout and asparagus salad.
Ooh.
I know, with fingerling potatoes and garlic croutons really popped out at me. So that is something that you'll probably not hear the end of until the next Blue Apron recipe that I'm excited about.
Did you know that Blue Apron was the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country?
That's very impressive, because I've been reading into it, and that is a very big industry. And I think Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system. They set the highest standards for ingredients, and they build a community of home chefs, which I feel like really good to be a part of. And I know you do as well.
If you're like me and you don't know how to cook, this is so easy that you don't have to know how to cook to be able to make a delicious meal from Blue Apron.
Tim, I'm going to tell you, you keep saying I don't know how to cook, but you now know how to cook.
I guess you're right.
Yep. And you know how to impact the community. It's crazy that you haven't even realized that you have learned how to cook and you're impacting the community. Blue Apron has established partnerships with over 150 local farms, fisheries, and ranchers all across the United States.
But maybe one of the best things about Blue Apron is how affordable it is. For less than $10 per meal per person, Blue Apron delivers seasonal recipes along with pre-portioned ingredients to make delicious home-cooked meals. And you can barely get a meal for $10 if you get takeout. I mean, you're pretty much talking fast food at that rate.
Fast food that's not guaranteed. Blue Apron's freshness guarantee promises that every ingredient in your delivery arrives ready to cook, or they'll make it right. And they do make it right for you.
So check out this week's menu and get your first three meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/missing. You'll love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron, so don't wait.
That's blueapron.com/missing. Blue Apron, a better way to cook.
Thanks to everybody for joining us here today. We really appreciate you all taking the time out of your busy CrimeCon weekend to come hear us schmoes talk. How awesome is CrimeCon so far?
Awesome.
It's amazing, right?
Yeah.
round of applause for the people at CrimeCon for putting this on. It's been amazing.
Yeah. And a round of applause for you guys too. It's amazing to talk to all of you guys. And I'm not gonna lie, I'm terrified right now. We do this over Skype. We do this like in the privacy of our home, so I've never had so many eyeballs looking at me. So
you've never had to wear pants before.
I've never.
He never has.
No one knows that I'm currently not wearing pants.
So tomorrow at 10 a.m. in the Grand Ballroom, we have a panel, us three again, and they're going to play a trailer from the new Oxygen TV show, which is about the Maura Murray case. 6-episode series on the case. And so you guys all got to come see that because you're going to go nuts for the trailer. That's a promise.
Yeah. It's actual, because of what CrimeCon represents, this series that's being made is an actual investigation into what probably would have turned into a folklore. It would have been 15 years, 17 years, 25 years, and because of the responsible people who go to this and listen to this, it's generated enough interest to have a major production company relaunch a case. It's incredible. So
I think it's going to, I mean, not to jinx it, no pun intended.
Downer.
I think it's going to be on par with Making a Murderer, and I think the production quality is much, much better than what it is from what I've seen.
Yeah. There's certainly going to be more information out about this case than ever before after this TV show, and if it doesn't solve it, which we don't even know if it has or is going to, but if it doesn't, it's going to really clear the picture, I think, for everyone, and limit the possibilities of what happened to Maura Murray. So I think later we'll take a few questions, and if you guys want to talk about the show or talk about whatever, we can certainly answer your questions. But I think we wanted to first focus on some of the stories over the past couple years that we've been doing this documentary and podcast. We have James here, and trolling is one of the more interesting parts of what we do. And it's something we've really never directly talked about and devoted an episode to. So I think that's kind of what we want to do here. So Lance, why don't you first tell us about your experience with Alden and the Happy Anniversary video?
Sure, yeah. And this actually, this is something that James is directly related to in the story back when Alden, when was it? It was 2012? No, 2014?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, it was on the 9th anniversary.
Okay.
It was on the 9th anniversary. Tim and I would do
2013 then.
Yeah.
Yep.
Tim and I do we would do video editing on the side, and it was really boring. It was like corporate stuff or mitzvahs or wedding videos, and during that time you have this period of like rendering. So if you edit something, you make a cut and you render it. So you have like 20 minutes or so, 15 minutes to where you have this downtime. So I hadn't looked at James's blog in a while, and we were working out of this small office space in East Boston in a warehouse that was about 80% empty. And it was an affordable spot, and that's why we did it. But so I was there alone. It was I don't know. I was rendering something, and I thought to myself, it's coming up on the anniversary. I haven't looked at James's blog in a little while. I'll go to the blog. I'll refresh the page, see what's going on. And I did that, and I saw the first James's headline said, "What the hell is this?" And it was the video that Alden posted of the ski ticket, cross-country ski ticket to Brenton Woods, and the title of the video was just Maura Murray, and it was a slow zoom into the date. I'm like, what is this? So I called James, first time I've ever talked to him, and I said, you know, we have a conversation, and I remember him saying, this may confirm some suspicions about a certain individual that I've been looking into. And I was like, oh, crazy. Like, you know, I'm all jittery, and I'm, you know, trying to edit, and I'm refreshing the YouTube page that Alden posted it on, and I'm refreshing, and I see the videos go from one uploaded to two. And I was like, holy shit. He just posted another one. And I watch it, and if anybody's seen the Alden Olsen Happy Anniversary video, if you haven't seen it, I'll give you the brief synopsis. It's a man in his mid-50s, slightly overweight, glasses, very unhinged looking from here up, background is brick, kind of a red hue to it, And he is cackling, old person, crazy, cackling, laughing, and rocking back and forth. And there's this classical music going on behind it. And I am stone cold with fear because I'm positive he's at the door. I'm positive he's at my office door. The hair, you know, you hear the stories like the hair on the back of your neck stands up. It literally happens when you get that. It is the single scariest thing I've ever seen in that particular isolated moment. And he's rocking back and forth. And all these thoughts are like, I'm watching the guy who kidnapped Moore Murray, and he's taunting us. And he suddenly stops laughing and winks at the camera, and it fades out, and it says, happy anniversary. And I have my phone, and I'm calling James, and I, did you see the new video? And he's like, there's a new one? I said, yes, watch this. And I can hear him watching it. And it ends, and he goes, that was particularly disturbing. And then I said, and this is the part that James had a well of information on Moore Murray. And I said to him, is this the person that you were talking about when you said this might be somebody that you were looking into, a person that you were interested in? And he goes, I have no idea who this person is. And I was like, James Renner doesn't even know who this guy is. This is the guy. It turns out that Alden went on to make, what, like several dozen videos. So we ripped it.
Oh, yeah.
James is like, can you get this off of YouTube? And I was like, it's 75% done. Like, it's so we just...
Because the fear was that this was the guy that did it.
Yeah.
And we needed to get this down and before he took it off YouTube, if he did.
Yeah.
And you got it right away. And
which
of course,
he did do.
Later that yeah. night. Yep. Yeah.
And he had named himself 112 Dirtbag, which is what Fred had called the person who took his daughter, some local dirtbag. She went missing on Route 112. So he was the first experience. I, not kidding, spent months analyzing his videos.
Yeah.
Analyzing the little drawings that he had. And he just got off on sprinkling these things out there and just watching what people would do. And that was my first experience with trolls.
It escalated from there, though, where to the point where I logged on one night and there was a video that he had uploaded that was my 5-year-old son. The first time I saw it, I thought, oh my God, is he filming? Was he filming from outside of my house? But then I realized that these were all stills manipulated through whatever editing software he was using. So they were zooming in and all this crazy stuff. And he had taken these photos from Facebook. And I had a very public Facebook profile at the time. And I always prided myself in that. I was when I investigated these true crimes and just to be very open, because the way I like to report is to be very open with my evidence and notes and everything. So why not be open with my personal life as well? And I've since changed that because of this. And he had like 100 pictures of my 5-year-old son up there. So that began this long conversation with the prosecutor's office near UMass Amherst, where Moore went to school and where Alden works as a Walmart greeter. We tried to prosecute over this, and I was on a conference call with the prosecutor and the lead detective, and they told me they were not going to prosecute. And I said, well, what's it going to take? What if this guy... We did some investigation, by the way, and we found out Alden Olsen had a criminal record for trying to murder a member of his own family. So if that's the way he treats family, you know, who am I to him? So I said, you know, what happens if this guy shows up at my doorstep with a shotgun? And there's a pause, and then the sheriff said, well, then we have a pretty good case. So that's as much as the law enforcement would do about online trolls. But he was, I'd like to say he was the worst, but I don't know if that's even true.
No, Alden Olsen doesn't realize what he is.
Yeah.
The type of people that he influenced and that type of mentality, I don't believe they really know what they truly are. I think they think what they're doing is somehow noble, to throw chaos into what is, you know, we have our differences as far as the case and conclusions, but then there are the people that want to completely destroy it. And no matter what happens, I know no matter what conclusion this case comes to, I know both you and I will say, I don't care if I was right or not. I don't care. It's done.
That's true.
You know, there's something happened. It's done.
That would be wonderful.
Yeah.
And I would be really upset if I was wrong, though.
You would be. Yeah. Tim throws things.
Yeah. I'll throw stuff at you guys right now.
Hits me.
James, how many hours did you spend trying to crack Alden's codes?
I have no, I mean, way too many. I became obsessed with it for a time because it felt like the Riddler, you know, and I was Batman and I was going to figure it out. And, you know, this,
I think I was more like Batman though.
I was actually going to say that I was Batman. You're kind of more like Robin.
I was more like the George Clooney Batman that nobody watched, you know, you're more like the Keaton,
the Michael Keaton yeah. Batman. I'll take that.
Okay.
Okay. Go on.
And
cross off Batman.
And he really was like the Riddler because he would put these YouTube videos up there and they would have these visuals that would be like a lightning bolt and then numbers. And you had to figure out like what the numbers matched to and if it was a road and these names that he would put on these videos and how they related and whether they would lead you to where Moira was being held captive. I mean, it was crazy.
We would get emails that had it would be something that he drew, which was a face, and then it would be a comparison to an area of land up in New Hampshire. And if you looked at them, it looked like the eyes are here, and that's a lake, and then the eye here is this other lake, and then you know the weird like lightning bolt or something, and the crooked smile looks like the road. And yeah, you'd sit there and look at it, and then you just kind of know that he just did it so that you would waste so much time.
He insinuated himself in my life in various creepy ways too. There was an incident that I talk about in True Crime Addict where it's a long story, but my sister was being stalked and I went to the courthouse to help her with this problem. And we went in front of the judge and the judge basically said, you know, are you her lawyer? And I'm like, no. He's like, then get out of my courtroom. And I started talking back and explaining how my sister was in danger. And he said, if you say one more thing, I'm going to find you in contempt. And of course I said one more thing. So I ended up in jail for 5 days over contempt of court because I called the judge a drunk, which he was. So I get out of jail and, at that time, I'm teaching English comp and fiction appreciation at the University of Akron and Kent State. And he got my police record and sent it to my bosses at both places to try and get me fired. You know, it has nothing to do with the Moore case, has nothing to do with anything. It didn't work, you know, but it was an awkward conversation with the dean. So, you know, and it's something... I mean, I've run into trolls in other cases, but nothing to the degree of the Moore Murray case. Something about this case brings them out.
Have any of you, I want to ask to the audience now, have any of you guys tried to figure out what any of Alden's videos mean? No?
And some nodding heads.
Okay.
Well, they're not going to raise their hands.
Well, it's basically, do you guys consider it wasted time?
100%.
Yeah.
100% wasted time.
And then, and that was the beginning of the trolls. I mean, you dealt with one when you guys were in New Hampshire. And, like, you hear things like, somebody sent me a picture of a penny, and I had to run away from New Hampshire, which sounds ridiculous, but it's scary when you're in it. You got to explain the penny thing.
Yeah, so once upon a time... there was a set of coordinates that were sent to James that said, stop looking.
Oh, yeah, stop
and it was
looking.
Coordinates. So we figured out where the coordinates were. It's like, we have to go find this. We have to go find out what they're talking about, what's there. And it's about a 3.5-4 hour hike up one of these mountains, Desolation Trail. It's Desolation Trail,
yeah,
right?
Because, yes. Of course, it's Desolation Trail.
Right. It couldn't be like Happy Sunny Trail. It was like, you're going to die trail. So it took a while. We kind of forgot about it because you got the email and it was out of season. You know, the hiking season in the White Mountains is not limited, but, you know, in order to coordinate a bunch of people to go do this and then figure out that you have to, you know, it's a 4-hour hike in, 4-hour hike back. You're going to be looking around and then you start thinking that's going to be a full day. I might have to camp there. Right. So anyway, we decided we're going to go do it. Tim and I, a friend of mine who was very familiar with the White Mountains, he's a hiker and a tracker, and he knows the area. I convinced him to come with us. He had a GPS thing, and we were ready to go, and we stayed at a motel up there.
Well, let me back up, because we booked hotel rooms in Lincoln, New Hampshire, for the trip. And we started thinking people were potentially monitoring our emails because of this. Before we even left for Lincoln, we got this penny tweeted to us deep in the trenches of hashtag Maura Murray. It's a 1982 heads up penny with obviously Abraham Lincoln is on the penny. So we were like, well, that's weird. We just booked a room in Lincoln and now someone's sending us a cryptic message with Abraham Lincoln's face on it.
And Maura was born in 1982.
Yes.
And I know how this sounds. It sounds like they're crazy. But people have literally hacked into our emails. At least they've hacked into mine, and you've.
Oh, I'm.
They've tried to hack into yours.
I'm positive.
They may have at that point.
Yeah.
Seems like it.
Yeah. We were also simultaneously getting emails from a troll named Miles Wainwright, and I don't even want to tell you how much time I wasted looking up the meaning of the name Miles Wainwright, and he sent us a link to the Echo and the Bunnymen's Killing Time music video, and was talking about the moon and the moonlight that, you know, the night she went missing. And right. So we were going back and forth with him kind of on email, not really engaging.
No, I was engaging. I was really curious. I asked him what he knew. You know, I said, what makes you think you know what happened to Maura Murray? He said, I never said I know what happened to Maura Murray.
Yeah. So... So we meet up with the hiker up there. We get our room, and did anything happen before the email that made us leave?
I think, well,
the phone call, right?
Oh, the phone call was next morning. So
we were also hanging out with a medium that night, who may or may not be a real medium. I'm not really sure. We're there at the crash site at night, hanging out with a medium who's telling us that Maura's talking to him, and it just puts you in a creepy mood, or you know, a creeped out mood.
So we're back at the we're back at the motel, and this guy Miles Wainwright keeps emailing us, and the email that put us over the top was a reference to another unsolved murder in that area, and it was Tommy Conrad, and he made it in the course of the dialogue he wrote it was about people minding their own business, and he said, just Tommy Conrad was basically assassinated in his mother's front yard for not keeping his goddamn mouth shut.
For not minding your goddamn business.
Right. Not minding
your goddamn business.
And we read that, and Tim at the time had Violet,
yeah.
And was a new dad, and he's like, fuck this. I'm not doing this.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like we thought someone was going to hurt us going on that hike. It was also coordinates that, it was the second time the person sent the coordinates to James with a creepy rhyme to it that said, was it 2 years ago, I told you where, look again, she's still there.
Yeah.
And
we were worried that you'd go up there and step in a bear trap.
Right, because, I mean, who doesn't want to put James Renner in a trap, right? I mean, the guy, we knew that it wasn't going to be, you know, you go up there and you start, you know, oh my, there's a significant piece of evidence right here. But we started thinking there's a certain mentality in that White Mountain area, and there are things like Army Navy stores, and there's people who have old landmine memorabilia. These things could, and we started rolling that around in our head, and the reality of it just really, really hit home. And
yeah, we kind of thought that there was a better chance that there was a trap waiting for us than Maura's body, for example.
Yeah.
Which
didn't somebody call the hotel room too?
Yes.
Later
that night.
Yeah, we hadn't fully decided that we weren't going to go. We were like, all right, let's cool down. Maybe smoke a little pot or something. Chill out a little bit. And the next morning we get a call. Our hotel, the motel room phone rings, and I answer it, and it was like 6:30 in the morning or something, and I answer it, and there's nobody there. It's just a click. And then the guy who we were with, this tracker hiker guy, we met up with him like an hour later, and he said, he was like, you guys call my room this morning? Mm-hmm. And we said, no. And he goes, oh, I just had a phone call. No one was there. And I asked the front desk. And she said, oh, maybe your buddies called you. And we're like, dude, we had a phone call too. And that's, I think that's when we were like, this definitely isn't happening right now. could have just been a weird coincidence, but with all the series of events that went down the previous night, getting prank phone called the next morning, seemed like there was a presence there that wanted us to not stay.
It seemed like someone knew exactly where we were.
Yeah.
And there was no deadbolt on the hotel door, which was a little nerve-wracking. And we really didn't have weapons. Like, we're not gunmen. We don't carry guns. We had a knife, like very dull.
The Swiss Army knife.
Yeah, like, yeah. It's not really going to do much.
I'd like fingernail clippers.
So we were in trouble if someone actually really was going to approach us.
The craziest, I don't know if it's the craziest thing, but, you know, right around the time that the book came out, somebody was deliberately trying to hack into all my social media accounts and my personal email. And they actually managed to do it, but I was able to, you know, fix it pretty quickly. They sent me a link. This is the lengths that they went to. They sent me a link, an email from my, it looked as though it was from my editor at FS&G, and it was through her email account. So they made it look like it was coming from, which I have, and I know it's her, when the email comes in. And it was, you know, signed by Sarah, and it said, hey, have you seen the latest draft? Now, I should have known then that something was up because there was no draft for me to look. We weren't working on a book at the time, but this is from my editor. She's saying draft. I'm like, so I click on it, and it says to access the server, you have to type in your password. And so I type in my email password, and it goes in. And as soon as I hit return, I'm like, God damn it. So, you know, I call this guy, you know, a friend of mine that works in IT security, and he walked me through the steps I had to take to, you know, to fix it. But they, you know, if they were quick about it, they would have been able to get into my email very quickly and, you know, I don't know. So, you know, there are people that, you know, you get your normal trolls that'll just send you threatening emails or, you know, just call you a jerk or whatever. But then you have very sophisticated types in this case that that are trying to get at information we have or take down our social media or, you know, publicity, things like that.
When we got back, I went to my day job, and we have an IT guy, and I took the header of the emails from Miles Wainwright, and I said, can you figure out where these came from? And I didn't show him the emails. He just needed the header information. And he came back to me a little while later, and he was like, oh, yeah, don't worry about that. That's just a bot. And I said, no. I've talked to this person. Like, he answers questions. And he's like, seriously? I said, yeah. And he said, like, this is buried where this is. He was impressed at the length that this person went to bury the information that would lead to the identity.
Wasn't there a message encrypted in there that we still, to this day, don't even, never deciphered? Yeah.
Yes, there was. I can't remember. But yeah, it's and even to this day, people still screw around with us. Someone randomly emailed us, and she's a hiker, and she had never heard about the case. Went to the White Mountains, went to the mountain that the coordinates were on, and said, "Hey, I found these ribbons that say Moore Murray, and they were tied to a tree. R.I.P. Moore Murray." And I was hiking Desolation Trail, and, you know, I looked into it, and my roommate was like, you got to talk to these guys who do this thing. And so we called her, and we verified that she's a genuine person. This person's not lying. And I'm not going to say we found out what happened, but the lengths that people will go to just to create some sort of chaos is remarkable. That means somebody went up, and it was right before the branch where you can go the major route on Desolation Trail and go kind of back down. And it was right at that fork. So someone actually hiked. They went up there, they made these little ribbons, and they tied them off, and they put keywords on it. I'm not going to get into it because I don't want to give people attention that they don't deserve attention, but they put keywords on there so that when we saw them, we go, God damn it, that's the same person, you know? And it turned out to not quite be the same person, but it was keywords that only we would know. Thank you.
Lance, what do you think of MHZ choice?
Well, you know me and my British drama love. I love a British drama, especially if you have this detective who's grizzled and probably an alcoholic, probably in a bad marriage, falling apart. And the one thing that he can hold on to is his incredible intuition and his doggedness when he's pursuing a case. So you know that's my weak spot. Why do you ask?
MHZ choice, they feature European mysteries, dramas, and comedies streamed right to your computer, TV, or favorite device.
That's cool. Can I get an award-winning true crime series like Almost Perfect Crimes and The Godless, plus acclaimed crime dramas like In the Face of Crime, Raid,
and Spiral, which has been described as a darker and more twisted version of The Wire? And you can binge all 5 seasons on MHZ Choice.
Do they have anything with Agatha Christie?
They got my boy Andy Garcia in an Agatha Christie show. In addition to Agatha Christie stories, they have Donna Leone and Camilla Lackberg. Yeah, and new content is added each week, so you'll always have something new to watch, all with English subtitles, just in case.
Is there anything that you've been watching?
Oh, well, the Andy Garcia show.
Oh, yeah, hashtag Andy Garcia. That is, as you said, your boy.
Andy Garcia in Agatha Christie's Family Murder Party. It's just my favorite. I love an Agatha Christie show, and I love Andy Garcia.
So you'll get that. You'll get Andy Garcia, Agatha Christie, plus the entire MHZ Choice library. I hear this includes over 2,500 hours of binge-worthy TV. It's got to be $20 a month, right?
It's $7.99 a month. And even better, you can try MHZ Choice free for 30 days. And after that, you'll save 50% on your first month.
So you're telling me it's under $8. It's 1 cent under $8, and you can try it for free for 30 days. And then after that, you'll save 50% on your first month. So I don't know exactly what $7.99 divided by 2 is, but that's what you'll be paying.
That is what I'm telling you, but you have to go to mhzchoice/missing and use the code missing at checkout. That's mhzchoice.com/missing.
And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. And remember, when you support our sponsors, you're supporting this podcast.
I've thought a lot about this. I think part of what's going on is I think what people are essentially doing is playing a real world Dungeons and Dragons game where they're almost like LARPing, you know, like they would be out there in the park wearing armor and with foam swords, but they're using this case as their Dungeons and Dragons manual. And it's real people that are involved in it. You know, Maura Murray was a real person. Her family's very real, and everybody that cared about her were real people. But they're creating this weird fictional fantasy story around this case that because they want to have fun with it.
Yeah.
It's for the lulz.
And I'm actually, I was a little concerned about us because I know people come here and you want to hear about the case. You want to hear about Maura Murray. You want to hear our opinions. I was thinking, well, should we talk about trolling? Because we never really talk about that on the podcast anymore. And I'm glad we did, because it just shows how responsible all of you people are. You're hearing the story and you're thinking that's crazy. And the reason why we were here, the reason why we got to this position with this case is because we listen to responsible people like you. There's
definitely a troll out here somewhere.
Yeah.
I think it's John Ronson.
But, you know, I'm glad that we talked about this, because this is one of the most important parts of what this, one of my favorite shirts over there was the one that says basically a detective. I think that's hilarious. But look what you do. Yeah. We got all of the trolling and all that was a big distraction, but we got so many more like productive people and you know, there's a show about it now. There's a legit investigation happening that's never happened for this case. And it's because everybody listened.
There was also a blog, this happened several years ago, right when we announced that we were doing this documentary, probably sometime in 2014, there was a blog called Not Without Peril, written by a guy named Sam Ledyard, and it was about the Maura Murray case. He ended up taking his blog down because he was threatened by an online
character named Palmkick that has probably come up in the podcast before.
Palmkick loves me.
Palmkick has a thing for both of you guys, actually.
That's another thing. They all have their names, you know, like villains from Batman. You know, there's Palmkick and there's Dirtbag and there's...
And it, even if you look at the Urban Dictionary for Palmkick, it says an internet anarchist.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, cool.
So this guy threatened this guy, Samuel Ledyard, and when we saw the email, and it said, the blogger your wife, the blogger your wife, the blogger your wife, about 150 times. And then I think there was a smiley face kind of drawn into it, actually, using like dashes. The guy Samuel Ledyard, which isn't his real name, but he talked to a different person who is a follower of the case, who this person said that he isolated where, and he's like a computer guy, he's like a CPA. And so he said he isolated where Palmkick came from, where this email came from. And he said it was East Boston, Massachusetts, which was where Lance's studio was at the time. So this guy was literally trying to frame Lance.
Dun, dun, dun.
which is just another interesting thing. I don't know.
No comment on that.
Yeah. We know who it is. We actually, maybe a few months ago, a Reddit moderator from the Unresolved Mysteries page or the more Reddit page emailed us and said and asked us about this person and what do you know about this person? And we said, well, we think that person's Palmkick. And she's like, obviously. and she sent us emails where he pretty much admitted it. He actually did admit it in the emails, but he's kind of being jokey in it as well. But
oh my
he's
God.
Palmkick.
I just had a revelation.
What?
And I wouldn't have known unless we went to your talk. And this guy clearly might be a psychopath because the way we talked to him on the phone and the way he talked about Palmkick, like, oh, Palmkick wouldn't do this and Palmkick wouldn't do that. I'm not Palmkick because Palmkick wouldn't do, and all of these like self like grandeur like type things. Yeah. And it's like, oh, I'm so happy I learned something.
Yeah, he spoke about him. He spoke about him in high regard.
Yeah.
As if this was someone to be respected. And so we got off the phone and said, we are 100% positive this asshole is Palmkick.
Yeah.
One of my favorite moments in this whole thing involves a different troll who really, really ran amok on Twitter last summer. He called John Smith Palmkick, which he isn't. He also said John Smith, who's been on the podcast several times, murdered Maura Murray and was demanding his alibi for that night. It's like, well, John's like, I don't fucking remember where I was in this random day. Why would I remember? He's like, I was probably working.
And John Smith is exactly what this troll wanted. Because John Smith will not stop. He's like, he will not stop. If he's got an issue, he won't stop. He doesn't care. And if he doesn't like you, then it's on. And it's on publicly. Like, it's on, and you look at the comments back and forth, and anyway, continue.
We sent probably 50-plus emails to this guy. It went back and forth for a long time. We were trying to explain to him what he was doing is damaging and really wrong. He also at one point said Fred Murray was Palmkick. Which
you
is
idiots. How can you not
like,
see?
Yeah.
Right.
Fred barely checks his email. Like he's not doing this stuff. But my very favorite moment of this whole thing, these whole several years for us, was when Lance emailed this guy. He had enough of it, and he emailed this guy a really amazing email that started with "you motherfucker," and ended with "go fuck yourself."
there was a lot of stuff in there, a lot of text in between those bookends, but and as I was writing it, I knew I was like, "This is exactly what he wants. This is exactly what he wants." But I couldn't stop myself because it had gone so far. He was damaging the entire community that we were working really hard to build, and he actually pinned it to his Twitter as if people were going to look at that and say, I can't believe you were treated like that. I can't believe that.
I can't believe these guys would do that to you. I thought they were professional.
I got so many emails saying nice work. Like, that was the best thing I've ever read. Like, you idiot.
Yeah, that just made my day. We got emails and calls about that.
Yeah.
Not to open up a can of worms here.
Let's do it.
But oh boy. With all these anonymous trolls and this highly organized misinformation campaign on this one specific cold case. It gave me some chills when I finally learned that after West Point, Bill Rausch, who was Maura's boyfriend at the time, was involved for a couple years. He worked for this group in the military whose job it was to spread misinformation to the media, to use he worked specifically with newspapers in Iraq and Afghanistan, I believe, or maybe just Iraq, where they would feed fake news stories into the Iraq papers, and then the AP would pick it up and as if it were true news. So, you know, he and his friends, highly, highly trained and skilled in this sort of thing. I don't know if it was anything to do with him. I don't know if it has anything to do with friends, and they never even told Bill that this was what they were doing, or if it has nothing to do with anything. But it's always been a weird coincidence to me. But this case is full of weird coincidences, too.
Which that is one of the, I guess, one of the things that makes people addicted to the case is that you can't be trolled and then look at her ex-boyfriend at the time and have something like that happen and not think, wow, my computer was hacked. And
right. That's exactly what they do.
Her ex-boyfriend, who it's inexplicable why he was even at the, you know, searching for her, how he was even able to get out of West Point to go search for his girlfriend.
He was at Fort Sill at the time. And then you find out that Bill allegedly sexually assaulted a woman at this office in D.C. in 2011 and gets fired from the job over this alleged assault. And I've talked to the victim. I've talked to the women who worked with him, and they swear that he has a split personality, that he's one person when there's a man in the room, and a totally different person if there's no man in the room. And we know for a fact he lost the job over it. I've talked to Bill. He admits the allegation, at least. So that, to me, changed the whole way I looked at the case and what Maura was up to. I think at one point, I didn't think, you know, the worst thing I've ever done in the course of the investigation in this case is suggest that Maura Murray was a sociopath. But that's because I didn't have this information that she might, in fact, what she really was, I think, was a survivor, that I strongly believe she was in an abusive relationship or feared she would be, and left to, in part, to get away from that. And I think a very good motivator to remain hidden is a child.
Oh boy, you know. Here we go.
Here we go.
Here we go.
A little bit.
Let's open up for questions because we only have about 10 minutes left. What's up, Justin?
Why did you guys start your podcast?
We wanted to be like you.
We started the podcast because we had this documentary that we began in December of 2013. The very first thing we shot on that was going to Canada to quite literally look for Maura Murray with James Renner.
We were detained at the border, too.
We were, for a brief amount of time.
They're like, are you guys up to something? We're like, no, we're just going to go up there and look at churches, which, whose idea that was?
That was my idea.
And so they go into the vehicle, and there's all the these missing missing posters of Maura Murray, and they're like, okay, you guys got to go in the back room.
Yeah. Guy comes in with his cute little French accent, and he's like, who is Maura Murray? And we're like,
who is Maura Murray to you?
Yeah. And then they stole our staple gun, so we had to tape them to the. Yeah.
So
we went out to like staple, and James is like, "Where's the staple gun? They stole our staple gun."
We wanted more footage. We wanted to meet more people who are obsessed with this case because the documentary that we began in 2013 was about the people who are obsessed with this case. So it's actually not the easiest thing to do to just say, "Hey, I'm making a documentary. You want to talk about this? You're obsessed with this case. You want to talk about this?
Yeah, you're a weirdo."
Didn't really get us anywhere.
Talk about how weird you are.
So we decided to start the podcast to further the documentary, and it really worked. It introduced us to many, very many more people. Some of them are in this audience right now. Aurelia has been on the show. Justin's been on the show. Aaron back there has been on the show as well.
Are you going to show footage tomorrow?
No, we are not showing footage of our documentary. We didn't want to
take away from the.
We didn't want to minimize the oxygen shot.
Right.
No, just kidding. No, actually, quite the opposite. We didn't want it. Yeah.
Speaking of that, I think if I was you, I'd be feeling a little nervous and jealous of the oxygen shot that you've been doing for so many years. But you don't seem jealous.
The question from John Ronson was, are we nervous or jealous that the oxygen show is happening? And absolutely not. The oxygen show gave this case such a better chance to be solved than what we ever could have done. And we knew that from the beginning. We had trust in the production company and the direction they were going and oxygen.
Yeah, just their entire process. When we first learned that they were going to do this, we had a lot of conversations outside of conversations with the production company, and we'd raise our concerns and we'd write them down, and then when we talked to the production company again, we'd bring the concerns up, and then they would say no, and they'd tell us why. And just the entire process was, they gave us a sense of something real is going to happen with the case, and they included us in it. And we were able to contribute our information and the work that we've done so far, and that was really cool of them. So they can coexist.
Yeah,
it was cool.
And also it actually allowed us to focus more on the original intention of our documentary, which is about the people who are obsessed with this case,
which turned out to be us.
Yeah, in the process
of
making it.
I want to give away the end, but
yeah. Lance and I try really hard to not come up with theories. It's actually been one of the more challenging things about this whole process is not coming up with a theory.
Although we do hear really good theories, and I keep using this analogy of there's this little dark circle that was where the time and place that she went missing. And if you start working out from that and you take things at face value and don't assume that things are being lied, that there are lies. Like certain things that were out there about why she got to that spot probably are true. A family emergency, and my sister, and these things that you've read, if you take them at face value, they do bring her to that spot. Hopefully we will know what happened at that spot, but from a non-investigator standpoint, And seeing just the massive amount of reaction this case gets, we wouldn't be here if we had a theory and we stuck to it.
I have a theory.
No kidding.
Next part.
the one thing I want to say is what's interesting about this case. That so much about this case is interesting, but the way I describe it to people that have never heard about it is it's a Rorschach test. There are so many weird clues in this case that you're going to come to a very different conclusion than anybody else based on what you bring to it yourself. It's very much like that, I think. To me, a lot of people think I'm 100% sold on this idea that she's in Canada and hanging out in Quebec. I don't necessarily believe that. The only thing that I think I've come away with is I'm 100% sold in my heart that she was not traveling alone. That there was this tandem driver, another driver that was in a car ahead of her. She got in an accident. They turned around and picked her up and went on. Now, that person either took her somewhere and she's living her life and hiding, or that person is responsible for her murder. But that's where I'm at after years of investigation. And I know a lot of people disagree with me, and that's fine, and we can hang out and we can have a drink later. But that's where I'm at.
You can throw drinks at each other,
yes,
too.
The accident that she had after the party, mm-hmm. You said that the reason the cop let her go is because she wasn't drunk. So why would anyone talk about the party?
I think because it wasn't a party. I think it was a gathering in a dorm room that was 13 years ago. And I know James, I can feel him right now. and when people say, I don't remember who was at the party, and you hear, we don't know if it was a big party or a small party, if it was, you know, a couple of college girls having a couple of drinks. There are rumors that she left with a man. She didn't have her phone on her. I don't know what that all means. I don't think, to answer your question, why won't anyone say who was at the party? That was the question. I think because the answer is no one told James who was at the party. that possibly burned a couple of bridges for other people who asked, and now I don't want to talk about the case at all.
Well, now that's an easy thing for them to say now, but you talked to the police from UMass who spoke to Kate Markopoulos and Sarah Alfieri a week after the disappearance, and they will say that they were uncooperative from the beginning about talking about anybody that was there. In fact, we just found out maybe 6 months ago that Sarah Alfieri, and the party was supposedly at her dorm room, Sarah had a roommate that has never been interviewed too, who was ostensibly there, was at least one other person that was there, and she won't talk about it either, won't return any calls. Sarah, I've never met anybody that reacted the way she did when I showed up asking about that party.
You showed up at her door, knocking on her door and asking her about this party from 10 years ago. How would you expect her to react?
Well, I'm dressed kind of similar the way I am, and I don't think I think I come off as more of a Columbo likable type of guy. I didn't expect her to say, "How did you find me?" and then slam the door in my face. It wasn't, and I've talked to a lot of people in this situation, and you would think a lot of people would be fearful, but most of the times they're open for talking. You're a person that wants to hear their story. It's human nature to share that story. Even suspects of cases, they want to talk about this thing, even to the detriment of their own case. So I think it's weird. I think they're lying about... I think it's possible that party was a good pie party, that it was a going-away party.
It's convenient.
Ooh, John Ronson has a question.
You may have answered this and I missed it, but why did you just turn up at her house instead of, you know, emailing her?
Well, I tried the email and calling. She never responded. And she actually kept her address kind of hidden. It wasn't easily... I have a friend who's a private investigator who found her address. So,
and it still strikes you as strange that after she didn't respond to your emails, hit her address, that she would have said, "How did you find me?" and shut the door in your face, like that.
In hindsight,
that's a weird thing to do.
That.
You know, you drove several states to get there.
Well, I made it. It wasn't just that I went out there just to talk to her. I mean, I popped in on Julie Murray too.
She react in a similar way?
Yes, but she was much nicer about it. She was, you know, we did talk for a couple minutes, and you know, that was one trip where I got to the point in my reporting where, okay, these people haven't gotten back to me. I need to give them the opportunity to respond, and so I need to try to make contact there. So it was part of that wrap up tour, and I stopped in on a couple friends of Maura's. They were decent. They didn't come to the door, but they sent their husbands. And one of them sent me a nice email afterwards. So,
okay, maybe one more question. I think we're almost out of time.
Okay. Maybe two more questions.
Okay, two more.
So, given the fact that you have had this trolling and like, stuff with your kid, what is it that makes you keep doing this? Is it Maura? Is it because it's a challenge? Is it because you just love it? Like, what makes you fight the trolls and keep going?
I think because I scored high on the psychopath test. No, because you do see more positive movement than the negative, and you keep you learn how to like ignore it. The ignoring is really the key. You just ignore it, and it's like from Nightmare on Elm Street. You just turn your back on the monster, and it goes away. And if you're not fueling it, if you don't respond, then they go away.
But don't go to sleep.
But don't go to sleep. Don't ever fall asleep. But yeah, and then you end up, once you've been through that, and anybody who listens to the podcast, you see that there's a journey that Tim and I went on, and you kind of have to go on that journey, and that was part of the journey. And we wouldn't have appreciated all of the important information that we gathered if we didn't have to go through that and see both sides.
Okay, last question right there.
Or did I just stalk people? No, one of the things I came away with on that trip is there was a time where I thought maybe more as close friends from Hanson, Whitman area. I thought they might know where Maura was or might have more information. And I definitely came away with the sense that they don't. You know, if she's out there, she's not in contact with her old friends. And Katie's the one that sent me the email. She's like, thank you for what you're doing. You know more about this than I do. You know, we'd certainly like to find out what happened to our friend. So I came away with Julie Murray being an honest person, not hiding anything. But at the same time, coming away with the fact that I certainly think Sarah Alfieri and Kate Markopoulos have more information than they've ever shared.
One more question. Let's hear it.
I love Hanson. Oh, wow.
Yeah, the question was, have more people opened up? Are you specifically talking about law enforcement, or are you talking just...
Yeah.
Well, yeah, with the investigation that the show is doing, there's a law enforcement official who is part of the show, and he's, over the course of months, formulated a really good relationship with law enforcement, and every so often, he says, hey, what about those things that you didn't release and no one knew why you didn't release it? You think we could see some of that? And they slowly start to give him information because he's gained their trust, and he's not being deceptive about it. It's a way that he's got to play this game to get the information. So, yeah. Yeah.
There's a ton of information coming.
Yeah. No. No, they actually, that's kind of a misconception. They did the best investigation that they could based on the information and the situation at the time.
For sure.
At the time, they thought that she was going to show up at the Cottage Hospital, and it was a young woman who was drinking in her car and just wanted to leave the car while she went and sobered up. And they didn't approach it as no reason why they should have. They get a bad rap because it's a police force of four in a small town, and there's no reason why when you see a car that's got alcohol in it and the driver's not there and it's locked, you're going to say they're probably hiding out somewhere and they're going to come back. And she never came back 13 years later. So.
Thank you very much for joining us, everybody.
Thanks a lot, guys.